to Art If,
the podcast about art, life, and everything in between.
Welcome back to episode 9 of Art If podcast. I'm Yossi.
And I'm Hattie. In this week's gallery, we talk about art and protest. And in place of our usual interview, we have decided to invite a guest on to join our gallery. So all three of us will be discussing different kinds of art related to protest.
It's an extended gallery, if you will. But that means there's no provocation this week. But be sure to check out our mini-sodes to see how Hattie and I are doing on the other provocations. Some of these are really hard.
So hard! If you love this podcast, be sure to subscribe wherever you're listening to get the latest episodes and mini-sodes. Okay, we're ready?
Yes.
I feel like we have an audience now. I don't know what to do.
I know. That's okay. No, we don't have an audience. So we have a guest.
We have a guest today.
On the podcast today. But not an interviewee, like a gallery guest.
Yeah.
We have a gallery guest.
So Jacob messaged me after he'd been listening to, I assume you've been listening to the podcast and didn't just out of the blue. So we invited him to come on and share his ideas with us today. So Jacob, do you want to introduce yourself a little bit? Tell us a little bit about who you are and then go ahead and tell us about your gallery.
And the gallery theme for all of us, we took from your idea, which is art and protest. So we're all going to be sharing something in the gallery related to that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have been trying to get more into music criticism recently, like within the past like 6 months or so. And so I've been watching a lot of The Needle Drop just on YouTube, just because that was how I started with film criticism, was just watching white dudes on YouTube talk about it and then eventually figuring out what I was doing a little more and diversifying. And so just, he was doing a lot of stuff just with the Black Lives Matter movement. Now that it's really picking up steam again and everything, there's been a lot of people, especially in the rap genre, that have been doing a lot of new protest music. And so I was just interested in the history of it in general. And that's why I messaged essentially being like, I'd love to hear about this from you guys. And then Hattie was like, why don't you do it yourself? And I was like,
a good leader delegates.
That's exactly right.
So That's my way of saying I'm not an expert in this at all. I read a Vox article.
Perfect. You're right on par.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I thought that I would, just because it's such a, I mean, protest music is huge. So I narrowed it mostly to American protest music for brevity's sake. And I say brevity, but I have 4 pages of notes, so you know. But yeah, so it really, I mean, it started off like right at the beginning with Yankee Doodle Dandy in American protest music, because what Yankee Doodle Dandy was, a British song that was making fun of the colonies, and basically the Americans, quote unquote, just started singing it ironically to make fun of them.
So they to like make fun of themselves?
Yeah, it's kind of like, and I'm stealing this joke from Lindsay Ellis, because of course I said, I started researching this, and then she immediately put out a video on Bush era protest music that kind of covers a lot of what I'm doing. So, it was essentially this case of like, because Yankee Doodle Dandy is just making fun of the people in the colonies for just wearing tacky clothes.
It has a lot to do with the feather in the hat, right?
It's like nouveau riche.
Yeah, like macaroni, like it's put a feather in his hat and called a macaroni, because macaroni was like Italian fashion, was like super posh at the time, and so it's making fun of.
Wait, so the Americans were posh?
Well, they were posh. They were like gaudy, right? Like it was like nouveau. It's like Jersey. Yeah.
Like, we've never been able to do posh.
So they were making fun of them for being like, oh, like, you think you can just stick a, you can just, like, put a feather hat on and now you're so
posh.
But
then the Americans are like, oh, they called us fashionable. Let's call ourselves fashionable.
We'll take it.
So, yeah, I mean, it was essentially just, like, the rebellion going, yeah, we're tacky and we're loving it, you idiots.
That feels very American.
It does. Sadly, it does.
So, from there, like, the next really popular or, like, really influential wave of American protest music is slave songs for when they're, I mean, kind of self-explanatory, trying... like just songs about being enslaved and the atrocities of it. So the most famous one from that is Go Down Moses and Louis Armstrong. Louis Armstrong has probably the most well-known rendition of that one. And then James Brown's Body during the Civil War, the Union wrote it as a rally song. And up until this point, like up until like the 1930s, essentially, is the era of protest music as call and response. Of this idea of like, we make the music really simple, we make the lyrics really simple, it's super earwormy so that you can just sing it back
That makes sense.
It's almost like sport chants, like sports songs, like at English soccer games or football, like the military songs even.
For sure. And so
that feels like it's really solidifying the style of what I think of when I hear protest songs and the kinds of things I've heard in more contemporary times is these sort of like very short, very quick kind of repetitive phrases.
Yeah. I wonder if that comes out of like... Black music style too. I mean, right? Because that's often a thing in, you know, African American coming from like African music, right?
Yeah. That call and response style. So for sure.
That'd be interesting if it came out of like the origin of like.
I mean, almost everything on this list is like white artists. It's either black people protesting being mistreated or white people being like, your black music is pretty cool. Why don't I just.
Right? Isn't that just like the history of music?
The history of the U.S. The history of
and
music.
And everything else. All right.
But so in 1930, that's the start of like electronic recording. And pop music is born out of that. And so protest music through that becomes much more... like detail oriented and a lot less simplistic. So like the first big one to come out of this time period is Strange Fruit. And that one I'd heard of it, but I had never listened to it. And I went through and I mean, it's long and meandering and just like, it's not intended to be like everything previously had just been like, really like catchy and something that you could sing along to and stuff, but this was very different. Like this was the start of something where you could have like this much darker tone and this much more intricate
almost like a mourning.
In some ways it doesn't feel like, oh, this is a song I'm gonna go sing at a rally, but this is a song that I'm gonna leave on the historical record as a protest against what is happening. I don't know. It feels in some ways like the aim of a song like that is much, much more focused towards like the larger scope of history than the moment.
Yeah.
And like archiving the moment when so much black history has been erased.
Yeah. It's such a haunting song. It's beautiful and devastating.
Mm-hmm. And so then from there, we get into folk music, which like basically from the 40s through the 60s was like the place to be in terms of protest music. So like This Land Is Your Land, which I've always heard as a super like patriotic song, was actually written in opposition to God Bless America as like a protest song. But a lot of like there were a lot of lyrics that were like very anti-capitalism and very critical of America that were cut. That the producers essentially cut for the actual recording of it so that it would be more broadly appealing and less scathing, I suppose.
Always got to silence those Marxists.
Be quiet, Yossi.
Hey!
And then in 47, because like Marxism and communism is such like a huge piece of this era of music, and 16 Tons by Merle Travis, I want to say is his name. This one was super interesting. I performed it for my voice lessons a few semesters ago, but it was about Merle Travis grew up in this town in the 20s, but the whole idea of it was that it was founded and run by a business, by this coal mining business, and so everything in the town was like completely separate essentially from the rest of America. Like the workers were paid in like essentially Disney bucks, but for this company. Wow. And they owned every store in the town, they owned everything, and so it was essentially like this slavery with extra steps was kind of what was going on, because like they had no money that was good to anybody outside of this town, and so they were stuck there forever. And so 16 Tons was written as like a frustration from that experience. It's so crazy, like just learning about all that. I just thought was so interesting, and I don't feel like many people have heard about that like these were like, I can't remember the exact name of the towns, but like they were super super common like at the turn of the century. And I don't know, have you guys heard about them? Because I sure hadn't until
now. There's so much about all of these songs that I like, they get built into our repertoire of our cultural repertoire, and they get separated from their original meanings, and they get misused, and sort of like the Yankee Doodle song, right? Like yeah. We sing that in elementary school and stuff, and it has no meaning to us. We just think it's funny because it says macaroni. Right.
I just keep thinking, like, when do you turn to music, you know, as the method of delivery of your protest message? It's interesting to think about, like, when is music, when is a song the most salient form of protest?
Well, when it's free, because you, your voice, right? Like, I mean, yes, there's instrumentation and all of that. Yeah, but.
That's true. As opposed to like art or something, you're saying like there's no materials needed.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, right. Yeah. I see what you're saying. I don't know. I think to me, a lot of it was either just coming out of like, oh, I am a musician already. And so like, it's just kind of like, oh, why did you paint your feelings? Why not write a novel about like what's going on? It's like, I don't know, 'cause I know how to paint. I don't know how to write a novel, like something like that. But then in addition, it is just kind of this thing of like, because like you can tear up, you can destroy like a lot of forms of art, and even something like theater, which is super here and then it's gone. Whereas music is something that can't really be silenced. Like it's something that'll always like stick with you in that way. Mm-hmm. Like I don't think I'll ever, after hearing 16 Tons once a week for my voice lessons for an entire semester, like I'll never get that melody out of my head.
Yeah, it's something you can carry with you.
Mm-hmm. And so then,
cool.
Like the last piece of folk music is then obviously Bob Dylan. Blowing in the Wind and the Times They are Changing were like huge for the anti-Vietnam movement, but also the civil rights protest. And that's where we kind of get this start of lyrics that are a little more universal and less specifically about what's going on with you personally, because that was part of like Bob Dylan didn't write any of his music to be specifically about these things or for like protesters or anything, but they were just taken, like they were just co-opted by them. And I don't know, it didn't say this explicitly, but kind of the vibe I was getting from it was a big part of why Bob Dylan moved away from acoustic and moved towards like electric guitars and everything was because like his music was being used as like protest and he was being heralded as like this leader of the movement and he didn't want it. So he wanted to change his sound to get away from that.
I recently watched the documentary on Nina Simone that's on Netflix, and she was really well known for a lot of her. Am I stealing your thunder? Are you about to talk about her? No. She had a lot of songs that were really explicitly about the civil rights movement and pretty radical. And then because of her radical stance on these things, she ended up not being able to shake that and almost lost her career because people didn't want to see a militarized black woman fighting. You know, she ended up moving to Europe and. Actually, she moved to Africa and then moved to Europe. But I recommend that documentary for anyone who's interested. It unfortunately has a lot of resonances with today.
Gotcha. Yeah. And I mean, the next point is soul music. And that gets – and the first song on there is Mississippi Goddamn.
Well, that's her. Yep. Okay. So I – sorry.
Good transition, Yazzie.
No, that one – and that's where, like, we – like – Mississippi Goddamn, probably more than anything else on the list, is so, in my notes, is so, like, the lyrics are so specifically rooted in, like, this one individual event that, like, you have to, like, go back, you have to, like, search for the allusions today because it's not something that's super present in our minds. Like, it's specifically about... Medgar Evans's death and the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Alabama in 62, I want to say. And then, you know, there's Sam Cooke with A Change Is Gonna Come, and then Marvin Gaye with What's Going On, which What's Going On, I guess, was one that I was really familiar with and just didn't pay enough attention to the lyrics to really... follow what was being said in it, which is the case, I feel like, for a lot of, like, the catchier, the more accessible songs on the list.
Yeah. The more popular pop music kind of ones that get played on the radio.
Oh, and then after that one, so we have Gil Scott-Heron's. He wrote this song called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, which is this... It's one of my favorites on the list, and I'd never heard of it before researching it. But it's a spoken word piece set over this jazz tune. And it's the whole song is an ode to the Black Power movement. And the one line from it that I think more than any of the others was like just kind of chilling and how applicable it is for today was... there will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay because the revolution will not be televised. And just like how many videos have we seen of police brutality that can get shared now through Twitter. And then you turn on the news and the same video is there, but it's been clipped right before anything actually happens. And it's like, see, they're not that bad. And like the whole song is just kind of about that, about how like you can't be passive about these issues or else if you're going to be gaslit essentially into thinking they're not as important as they are.
Yeah, that one's definitely really powerful and so much clear and direct commentary on power and who gets a voice and who doesn't get a voice, who gets represented and who doesn't get represented. Yeah.
And then from there, probably the most well-known, like when you think, I feel like when you think American protest song, you think Vietnam rock songs of like the 60s and 70s.
What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Say it again now.
We got that one. We got obviously Fortunate Son, Clarence Clearwater Revival, Gimme Shelter by the Rolling Stones. And then one that's kind of late in the game, like it wasn't released until 84, was Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen, which is a super interesting one to me because it's a protest song that's more protesting the aftermath of the war rather than the war itself, where most of the rest of them are, most of the rest of the protest songs of the era are like calling for peace, and Bruce Springsteen's is more retrospective and more looking at the bad things that they were made to do and then the treatment that they received upon returning from the war, which was really interesting to me.
Yeah, it's definitely a shift in perspective.
And then the next section I have is punk music.
All right.
Where, and I mean, that I think that punk is probably the best example of any of them of the medium is the message kind of thing. Where like the whole point of punk music is to be really stripped down and nasty and dirty, and like that kind of makes it perfect.
Well, yeah, and it's also about like de-skilling the music so it becomes more democratized. Anyone can do it, right? It's this whole DIY aesthetic was picked up by this movement and really sort of made to be counterculture so that everyone and anyone could participate.
And resistant.
Yeah. Function following form. That's what I was trying to say earlier. What is the name of the movie? There's 20th Century Women was a movie I watched recently, and Greta Gerwig's character is trying to explain punk music to Annette Bening's character, who just doesn't get it at all. And she says, like, she's like, they have like all these ideas in their head of what things should sound like, but like they're not talented enough to do it, and they don't want to be, because it's really interesting to see what comes out of people having passion without skill. And I just thought that was a really good explanation of the genre. But so Dead Kennedys are such a big one. Hollywood in Cambodia is a great one out of that. And then more recently, I mean, it's not really recent anymore, but it's more recent than that one, is Nazi Punks Fuck Off in 2007, which is pretty direct in what it's trying to say. and then I had been really meaning to listen to some of the Riot Girls subgenre for like a year now. I finally got an excuse to do that. So this was, I just think it's like just like the feminist movement in the 90s of like punk music democratizing who can get into it means that you have so many more female voices. And so like Bikini Kill was like one of the most, I think one of the most like the bands that stuck around the most from kind of that subgenre. And
Slater Kinney.
And their song Rebel. Yeah. So, A Real Man is the one I have from them.
God, I apparently don't listen to music. Like, Yossi knows like every fucking song you talk about, and I'm just sitting here like chiming in. Like,
I've just had a lot of people around me who are big music aficionados.
Oh, that's true.
Including my mom, who was disappointed when her daughter liked musical theater. She like went and saw Hendrix and Zeppelin, and she has all these stories and being in the 60s in Seattle and seeing everyone, and then I'm like, I love musicals. She's like, what did I do wrong?
I've been to a few concerts and they're just not my thing. I don't know, I would much rather sit in a theater and watch a musical than
I like both. They offer different things. I am somewhat of a punk fan myself.
I don't know why it just gives me anxiety. I think I get a lot of imposter syndrome when I'm at concerts, because like everybody else is just like so into it and just knows all the words and everything, and I'm like, I also like this band.
Yeah. That's mostly my life. Like, I'm at like a breaking event, like watching battles, and I'm just like, hi guys.
And then the last one in punk music is American Idiot, Green Day.
Which became a musical.
I mean that, yeah.
Boom.
I auditioned for that and it went so bad. That's a different story. But yeah, so that album was kind of the first real like punch to Bush after 9/11. Like there were some other things, but I mean, we're about to get into, you know, the Dixie Chicks in 2003 and their infamous concert that essentially ruined their careers because they were brave enough to say, hey, maybe we shouldn't be invading Iraq.
Right.
Doesn't seem like a great idea. This is under the country section, so we're going more recent with this one because we got to talk about some bad protest music.
Oh.
So we have Neil McCoy's Take a Knee, My Ass from 2017.
Oh. Wowza.
Is exactly what you
can
think
we,
it
do,
is.
But do we have to call that protest music? Can we call it something else? Because I like protest.
It's protesting of, the protests.
But I mean, it's like calling something art. Like just because I hate the Dr. Seuss Cat in the Hat live action movie doesn't mean it's not art. It's just there can be bad protest music, and it doesn't mean you have to disavow the whole genre.
Yeah, but it's like anti-protest music.
Yeah, it's I would say counter-protest music. But yeah.
Let's name it. I call it counter-protest music.
It's not an ideal song.
No.
It's pretty cringy. The lyricism is not
wait, so
good.
Not only is it like maybe not really a protest song, but it's like also like not well written.
I mean, look, I don't want to.
That's not at all.
Too hard on our boy Neil.
Yeah, he should be. Wait, his name is Neil, and he wrote a song that's against kneeling.
Let me see. When I see somebody on TV take their stand on bended knee, whether it's on AstroTurf or grass, I think of those whose freedom was not free, and I say, "Take a knee, my ass." That's the level of songwriting we're dealing with.
All right.
Lovely. I think I understand our country a little better now that I know that this song exists.
Yeah. There's good protest country music, though, which is what I'm about to get back into. Have you guys heard about the High Women?
No. Of course not. I haven't heard of anything.
Okay, so...
No, I have not. This one I haven't heard of either. I didn't hear about the other guy we were just talking about either, so...
Well, nobody should have heard about him. I don't know.
Country's not my forte, I will say.
See, okay, so the High Women are this group of female country artists, and they released like an album that is all about like it's self-titled. They released it last year, and it's all about like representation and these things. So the name is taken from this song from the 60s or 70s. Maybe 80s, doesn't matter. But it was written by Waylon Jennings, I think, and then he sings it along with Johnny Cash, Kris Kristofferson, and one other person whose name escapes me. But it's a cowboy song, and it's like this big, like long narrative. I mean, it's cowboys, like cowboys in the Old West. And so the High Women released this song called The High Women, and it's essentially a cover of that song, sort of, but they rewrite a bunch of the lyrics so that now it's a lot more inclusive, and it's about women and minorities and their struggles. Like, there's one of the verses is about a woman who was trying to teach math in the colonial days and was burned at the stake for it. There's something in there about like
I've always said math is evil.
I love math.
I can't stand
it. It's my favorite subject.
What are you doing?
I'm not even kidding.
She has a PhD in theater. Like what?
So I also loved calculus. We can be more than one thing.
Yeah. No.
But so, I really highly recommend at least that song. I haven't listened to the rest of the album yet, but I think that song is really powerful and just like in the context of the history that surrounds it and everything. I really love it.
Cool.
And so then we get into rap. I guess I can't say look at me, listen to me. I'm the perfect person to talk about rap music. But we can't really talk about protest music and specifically rap protest music and not talk about Fuck the Police.
I mean, that was honestly the first song I thought of when you started talking.
Huh. Yeah. I mean, it's a classic for a reason, and it's
classic.
Unfortunately ringing even more true today. Mm-hmm. I think, Because a lot of like people like who aren't super familiar with it, who are only really familiar with the, you know, the idea, the cultural impact that the song had, just think of it as like extremely simplistic and just like more of a rally cry, more of like a call and response almost kind of thing than anything else. But in Ice Cube's first, in his first verse, there's this one line, where he says, "But don't let it be a black and a white one, because they'll slam you down to the street to the street top, black police shelling out for the white cop." And I think that gets at the systemic racism that is still super misunderstood today. And like I've seen so many people talking about, oh, well, you know, here's these black cops who were arrested for police brutality. It's not a race thing. It's just some cops are bad. And it's like, but you're missing the point. You're missing that, like, it isn't just like only the white cops are the bad ones. It's about enforcing like this system that is oppressing minorities. And so, I don't know, just listening through and taking a closer look at those lyrics, that was the one that really shot out to me as one being really relevant and then two being more deep than maybe people give it credit for.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of that rap from that period gets a bad rap for...
Well, and I think a part of that it is because it's a subcultural expression that, like, put down as less than even just because of the hegemonic, you know, ideals and systemic racism.
All right, Jacob, we should have you wrap up.
Yes.
I was just with a W. That. You don't need to rap. It's okay.
Yeah. And then, like, from there, I get into, in my notes, I just get into, like, the LGBT movement and things like that. So, like, David Bowie and glam rock really brought a lot of representation in that genre. Like, you could be very flamboyant, and it was just part of the style, so it didn't matter as much. And then we get into some more stuff from today. And the Black Lives Matter movement. I can send you guys, I have like a playlist on Spotify that has like just everything and then some.
Oh, cool. We'll definitely like link to it if it's public.
Yeah.
Is it a public playlist? Is that how Spotify works?
Yes, it is.
Very cool.
All right. So I am bringing to the gallery today a group of women artists called the Gorilla Girls. Do you all know who the Gorilla Girls are?
I've heard of them, and I intentionally avoided them because I had a feeling somebody would talk about them.
Okay. That's somebody being me. Well, so they are a group of anonymous women who have protested, protested is a good word, but pointed out the gender disparities and the racial disparities in museums and galleries across the world. And when they make public appearances, they do so in gorilla masks, even though it's spelled gorilla like Gurria fighter, right? Like rebel fighter. So they started in 1985, and one of their first ads, they're usually like pretty basic text, and it was these are the museums that have had a woman solo exhibit. And it was like Guggenheim, zero, Metropolitan, zero, MoMA, zero, Whitney, one. It was like in 1985. They redid it at the 20th anniversary of it. And it still was only like 1-1-2-1. Like it has not gotten that much better. No.
That's insane.
Yeah. It's pretty insane. And so then the one they're really famous for, and I went and looked this up and now I'm forgetting. It's based on that French painting that is like, you see this woman from behind and she's nude and her spine is like longer than it should be. And it sort of ushers in the Romantic era.
Uh-huh.
It's something like the Odalisque or something. Don't quote me on that. Anyways, it's a really famous painting. If you saw it, you would recognize it. It's like a woman in spa. She's like stretched out on a chaise lounge and she's looking back. And they put a gorilla mask on her. And it says, does a woman have to be nude to be in the Met? And they went through and they had counted how many women artists were in the Met. And it was less than 5% of the artists, even though there were 85% of the nudes in the Met were female. So less than 5% of the artists in the modern, in the art sections were women, but 85% were nude. So, and it's huge. So I actually saw this piece redone in Minneapolis, and it was at the Walker Art Center or Art Museum, and it was like a whole wall, and it's this huge poster. And what's amazing about how they circulated these is they weren't in museums to begin with, but they would put them on like streets, like just, it was street art. They would like tack them up around museums and galleries. This one in particular was rejected by New York City Public Art Fund, but then they paid to have it run on buses until the bus company was like, actually, no, it's too risque. So they were really sort of rebellious in how they got their message out.
So if it's in a museum, it's okay to have a naked woman. But as soon as we take her out of the museum, now it's suddenly like immoral and problematic.
Well, it's also what she was saying, right? You're pointing out this disparity. They didn't like what she was saying. And so they took it down. But my favorite piece that they have is they have a piece that they did called from 1988 called The Advantages of Being a Woman Artist. And as I said, much of their work is just like text on, you know, in very block simple. And it says, working without the pressure of success, not having to be in shows with men, having an escape from the art world when you're 4 freelance jobs, knowing your career might pick up after you're 80, being reassured that whatever kind of art you make, it will be labeled feminine, not being stuck in a tenured teaching position, seeing your ideas live on in the work of others, having the opportunity to choose between career and motherhood, not having to choke on those big cigars or paint in Italian suits, having more time to work after your mate dumps you for someone younger, being included in revised versions of art history, not having to undergo the embarrassment of being called a genius, getting your picture in art magazines wearing a gorilla suit. So, it's funny. And their origin story comes out of, they were at a bar. So talking about the injustice, and they have a lot of ones that also point out racial disparity and the lack of diversity in American and European museums. But part of it was the sense of humor. And so there's been over 50 of them throughout the years. They change who they are, and then they name themselves after deceased female artists. So like Frida Kahlo or, you know, anyone that they want to have a legacy live forward. So I don't know. I just think it's a really attention grabbing, important thing they were saying. And they did it with like spontaneity and humor. And it's impactful. It's made a difference, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I think that even if people don't know like the history of them or always like pay attention to the depth of what they're saying, I think that they are recognizable as a group. And so that I think is important just in the grand scheme of women being represented in the arts, that like, I do think that people who don't know about art have heard of the Gorilla Girls, even if they don't know anything more about them. And like just name recognition is
right. And now they're getting commissioned. Yeah. And they're getting commissioned to do pieces now for large museums and stuff. So, I don't know. I think they're cool.
Cool.
So in 2004, there were like 3 female artists in museums around the world.
No,
that had solo exhibitions
in New York.
Oh, in New York. Still, that's basically the world. No, it's not.
Well, I mean, in terms of the art world, it's an important, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, here we go. So in 1985, the question is, how many women had one person's exhibitions at NYC museums last year? Guggenheim, 0. Metropolitan, 0. Modern, 1. Whitney, 0. In 2015, how many women had one person exhibitions at NYC museums last year? Guggenheim, 1. Metropolitan, 1. Modern, 2. Whitney, 1.
Oh, tokens. Mm-hmm. Perfect.
And then the other one I saw was like how Hollywood is worse than the U.S. Senate. So in 1999, it says the U.S. Senate is more progressive than Hollywood. 9% female senators, 4% female directors. Now, Hollywood is still worse than the U.S. Senate. Female senators, 25%. Female directors, 4% still.
Shut up.
Yep. So, right, they point out these things that are just a matter of counting, but then they, like, just bring them to light. They're also wow. known as weenie counts.
That's so cute. Well,
that's right. Something that we were, like, director's thing. Like, there was such, like, a hubbub or whatever about, like, Greta Gerwig not being nominated in this past year. And I got in, like, my girlfriend and I just had a very long discussion about, like, what the importance of it and, like, the idea. Like, I guess my worry is just that people focus purely during the award season. They're like, well, how come you haven't given these, like, the two female directors who have, like, gotten to make movies, how come they're not being recognized? And then, like, people feel, like, satisfied just being able to do that for, like, 2 months out of the year. And then for the rest of the year, just aren't vocal about it. Don't go out and support female filmmakers and things like that. And I was just worried that, like, it, like, just saying, like, why aren't women represented at the Oscars is just too easy a way to, like, kind of excuse that behavior.
The answer is because they're not represented in the work.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right, like the one woman director who's allowed to direct can't make an Oscar-winning movie every year, right? Like, I mean,
she probably could.
That's a lot of pressure. You're right,
but
still, it's hard.
Yeah. All right, what do you have at the gallery?
So I didn't really know what to expect when I started on this search. I guess I just assumed that it would be mostly like literal protests, like, right, picket posters and things like that. And I found like so much more. One of the people I ran across is Edgar Heap of Birds.
Yeah, I actually talked to him. I saw his work in Brooklyn this summer.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah, it was amazing.
Oh, cool. So he is of the Southern Cheyenne tribe, and he's enrolled in the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes. And he is most known for his text-based monograph prints. Broadly speaking, his work tends to explore issues of social justice related to indigenous peoples of the Americas and personal freedom to live within tribal circles. And he does do like some actual protest signs and posters and things like that. But the monograph prints are the thing that stood out to me as divergent from what I was expecting to find. So one of the series of monograph prints he does was called Genocide and Democracy. And it weaves together some of his own writings about the violence that indigenous people experience, the oppression of indigenous peoples in the Americas, with language he pulls from our quote-unquote documents of democracy, like the Star Spangled Banner, the Declaration of Independence. And so on these prints, he would write things that pull from both of those things. So it might say, with Indian genocide, crown thy good. Mm-hmm. Or shed grace on thee, American brutality. Or 500 years of violence, Purple Mountain Majesty. So they're just really poignant, interesting juxtapositions that I think bring out the conditions of life at the founding of this like newly imagined country between indigenous people and the colonizers. They just make really present this idea that when these founders were writing these documents and writing these songs and articulating their history, that there's all this violence going on in the background that they're explicitly ignoring, which was just like really, I don't know, powerful juxtapositions to me when I was looking at those.
Yeah, and I'll say, like, I don't know which work I saw. I'd have to look it up. But I definitely saw some of these monograph prints. I saw a few of them. And what they really do well is it feels like it's as complicated as, like, American history. Because, like, it even if you can't identify the sources so clearly, mm-hmm. like, it does feel very like polyvocal, like there are a lot of voices happening, and there are still, like, if I remember right, there are like print after print after print.
Yeah, there would be sort of in like a quilt pattern. Yeah. So there's right like 16 or 18 blocks or something.
Yeah, they're usually like two different colors, hues of the same shade, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And so what's cool, like, is that it does feel like you're hearing from a lot of people.
if that makes sense.
Yeah, and they like they sort of the language clashes together. Yeah. And so, right, there's not like grammar that weaves them together into these crafted sentences, but like they definitely, it's not a collage exactly, no, it feels like but fragments. They do like hit.
It feels like fragments.
Yeah, exactly.
But I just feel like, in, I haven't really thought about this, but there's very other little work I've seen that feels like it's multi, like there are multiple points of view. Mm.
Cool.
Yeah.
So, in reading more about him, one of the things I ran across is that he, while so much of his work is explicitly political and has this protest vibe to it, he also didn't get involved in a lot of the sort of like big name brand protests, if you want to call them that. So like he didn't go and be at the site of the Dakota Pipeline protests, for example. Mm. And part of what he says is that we have a joke. We're Indian every day. So that's how I look at it. From the tribal standpoint, we did this activism before. We do it now. We'll do it later. Mm-hmm. And so there's this interesting way that he's kind of suggesting that if we save our protest for these big moments, it kind of erases the daily struggle, mm-hmm. right? And so like what he's doing is trying to protest the conditions of daily life and make that present. And if he comes out in these big moments, then it maybe detracts from this other work that he's working on.
It kind of makes, it's different. Obviously, I don't want to make it seem like it's the same, but it does kind of remind me of like people right now where like people are really starting to worry that the BLM movement is just going to die out after a few weeks. And like people are really pushing for like, no, like keep, like, what was the, they're trying to placate you with the facade of change, but keep fighting is like something I keep seeing brought up.
Like with all these headlines that this municipality is considering change and then like, it's not going to go through, but we're going to not get that follow-up story kind of thing. Yeah. I think part of this too, is that like the act of not participating is a political act.
Hmm.
And so this like dovetailed into the other thing that I wanted to talk about, which is, so Christo Vladimir Javachev was born in Bulgaria and is known for these installations where he basically wraps giant structures in fabric.
He just died.
Do you know him? He did like 2 weeks ago. Yeah. So he did this work called The Gates in Central Park, where he like lined all the paths with these giant orange arches. And he wrapped the Reichstag in silver fabric, just like totally wrapped it up like a little present.
He also, didn't he do those fountains in the rivers in New York?
Oh,
the waterfall. They
probably.
Were like reverse waterfalls.
Oh, cool. He did one called Floating Piers in Italy, where he made these like floating yellow, structures that like went out into the river, and it attracted 1.2 million visitors.
Wow.
So like they're really impactful visually, and they attract a lot of attention because they're so big and interesting. And so,
and he worked with his wife a lot, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Jean-Claude something.
Yes. Just since I since the Gorilla Girls are on my mind, let's not forget that she was also a part of this.
Thank you.
Not that you would, but.
So he'd been working on this project in Colorado for 20 years.
Okay.
And he had invested $15 million of his own money into this project called Over the River. And the intention behind it was that he was going to suspend these silvery canopies along several miles of the Arkansas River. And I read in one place 42 miles, and I read it in another place 6 miles. And I think that discrepancy is because a lot of environmentalist groups were taking him to court saying that the structure would interfere with wildlife.
Oh, interesting.
And while the structure itself was only intended to stand for 2 weeks, it would take like 2 years to build. And so all that like construction work and stuff, right? And so it was going to be this huge, long, silvery canopy, and it would be on a part of the river that you float down a lot. And so as you're floating down the river, you'd look up and see this magnificent, vast artwork. Like, it sounds super incredible. And so you might be wondering, how is this protest art?
Yes. How is this protest art?
Right on cue.
Yeah.
So when Donald Trump won the 2016 election, Christo walked away from the project.
Oh.
Because it was going to be built on federally owned land. And, quote, "I can't do a project that benefits this landlord."
Oh, wow. Good for him.
And so he had invested $15 million, right, 20 years of his life in this project, and decided that he couldn't support, right, he didn't want to, on this particular land, in this particular context, carry out this project. And I mean, I think his hope was that, like, eventually maybe he would come back. But like you said, he recently passed away. And so it's completely abandoned forever.
What is it? I guess, is it just like outside of this specific one where, like, he stopped doing it? Like, what is it trying to say just generally? Or is it just like kind of beauty for the sake of beauty? Or is it?
I think it's just about sort of reimagining what we see, looking for other ways of identifying beauty, sort of looking creatively at the world around us.
Yeah, like reconfiguring spaces you may already know, right? Like Central Park, you know, but then when you have these beautiful orange gates, all of a sudden, like, you're reintroduced to the splendor of Central Park.
Yeah, and they highlight nature in a way, right? Because you see these things and they seem out of place, and by making them different, you see what's already there differently. So
yeah, because most of his work is in nature as well.
Yeah,
it's a collaboration but it's all stunning. It's all gorgeous.
It is. It's so. It is beautiful because they always take these big aerial shots too.
Like aesthetically, his work is just really lovely.
Yeah, and then like there is a little bit of a history of this idea of removing yourself from the art market as a form of protest. There was a man who did a commission for Ivanka Trump, and on the eve of Donald Trump's inauguration, he returned the $36,000 and denied having created that piece.
Wow.
He was like, this is no longer mine. I no longer participate in this thing being a part of the art world. I like revoke it, right? Because she's kind of known as an art collector. And then on the day of the inauguration, a bunch of galleries closed down in protest. So this also echoes the moratorium of art to end the Vietnam War that happened in 1969, where a bunch of major museums and galleries shut down in protest of the war. And so I just thought it was a really interesting take on how we protest and what it means to protest and how we participate in this dialogue of, I mean, because there's a huge financial sacrifice to these, right, these artists.
Right.
I mean, I suppose if you can afford to give up $36,000 or if you're charging $36,000 for a piece of artwork, like you're probably doing okay.
Well, he just also guaranteed like a bunch of purchases from like the liberal elite.
This is true.
I mean, if you want to be cynical about it.
No, this is true. But like Christo was funding that out of his own pocket. That $15 million was all his own money over time. Mm-hmm. And he was like selling other artworks in order to fund it. But it wasn't like grant funded. It wasn't federally supported or anything like that. But yeah, I just thought it raised the question too of like, what should art do in protest? Is it about uniting us? Is it about redirecting the means of production? Should these galleries have, instead of closing down and shutting off their artwork and keeping their artwork from the world, should they maybe have held a competing event, right, to redirect attention away from? Because there's a lot of dissent about how this non-participation is, how effective this non-participation is in terms of, in the art world. There's a lot of dissent.
Yeah,
about
I mean,
it, so.
I think that that's really relevant right now. I mean, in terms of like a lot of what we have to do in COVID, even though there are these protests going on, is about not participating. So finding alternative ways to participate if you can't go to the protest, for example. yeah. right? Or what does it mean to protest, but not like with your body?
Yeah.
Right. Maybe it is a daily thing or a daily practice, not just a going to this one march on a Saturday.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of these protest songs too, though, there's been a lot of criticism of the music world for not being vocal during these protests.
Right.
So anyway, that's mm-hmm. my gallery.
Yeah, that's awesome. I know, I'm just thinking too about this non-participation.
We talk about like boycotting businesses, right? Mm-hmm. And in some ways this is, there's a way in which it's kind of boycotting. It's definitely, right? The idea isn't that art making stops.
Right.
It's just withheld from the market. And I think that in and of itself is an important, not feeding into the people who already have power that are using their power against you, right? Like not allowing them to exploit your labor in a certain way.
Now who's the Marxist?
Thanks, Jacob, for offering that gallery topic to us and for joining us on today's episode.
And thank you to our listeners. We couldn't do this without you. If you want to know more about anything that came up during our discussion, make sure to check the show notes.
And be sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArtIfPodcast, #ArtIfPodcast.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast. And if you are, make sure to rate and review us. 5 stars, 5 stars. Okay. Next week, our gallery theme is art and technology, and we invite multimedia performance artists and our friend Sahar to join us for the interview.
Art If Podcast is produced by
Hattie Cry
and Yasi Jahanmir.
Our theme music was composed by Muhammad Abdul Salam.
Follow us at Art If Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook to stay up to date on upcoming episodes and to join our vibrant community of artists.